We're now going to take a look at the crimes of the corruption of youth and pedophilia. If you think that these crimes are only happen in the Vatican II Church, you're sorely mistaken. It goes all the way back to the beginning of the Great Apostasy in the 11th century. And we're going to look at evidence right here about in the 1400s where the corruption of youth and pedophilia was prevalent. We're going to start out by reading a letter from the notorious heretic John Gerson. All right, and his letter is titled A Complaint Against the Corruption of Youth, 1402. I condemn the filthy corruption of boys and adolescents by shameful and nude pictures offered for sale at the very temples and sacred places. They were selling naked pictures right at the churches and the cathedrals. And why not? They had the naked pictures on the wall, so when a kid walked out, he can take them home with them and enjoy them all week. They were selling them in the back of the churches. Christian boys are initiated into sexual impropriety by ungodly mothers and impure maids to the silly laughter of lost fathers. Boys are led astray by most obscene songs and gestures and garments, even sometimes in churches and on most holy days and in most holy places. And there are many other detestable acts about which it is most shameful to think or even write, for these things exceed Sodom and Gomorrah. So you can picture what he's talking about. Homosexual sins, pedophilia, and all that with the kids. And he didn't want to mention it in this letter. And this is 1402 when he's writing this letter. Now, of course this is evil. You're selling naked pictures, which is bad enough, let alone in the back of the church in the cathedral when the people are leaving Mass and when they're attending Mass. Now, I'm going to again condemn the notorious heretic Gerson for an insufficient condemnation. All right, I'm not particularly saying so much here. He's talking about the youth, but he never said anything about the pornography and the vice images and the immodesty and naked pictures inside the churches that are on the walls, the pillars, the statues, the artwork in the cathedrals and in the churches, which were prevalent in his day. As you see when you look at the evidence on the desecration of holy places, he never said anything about it at all. So what about so according to him, it's okay if your young child goes to church and can look at the naked pictures on the pulpit and on the pillars and on the artwork all around them and get infected by demons of lust. That's okay. He doesn't care about that. As long as you don't sell them naked pictures on the way out of the church so he can take them home and look at them. They're both evil. The other one, as a matter of fact, is even more evil in one sense because it's permanently in the church and people are forced to look at it every time they go to Mass on Sunday and any time they enter the church. Nowhere in his letters or writings do I hear him condemning the desecration of holy places, let alone with idols, which is even worse than ones against sins of immorality. So he's right. Yes, this is horrible, selling new pictures on the outside. But what's happening? Think about this plot of the devil. He's got the kids going into these churches first and looking at the naked pictures, and lust gets incited in them. That's the first stage. Then they go, guess what? We can make some money off of this. If the kids already got infected by lust, sell them some naked pictures on the way out of the church. He can take them home and enjoy them and look at them all week. And on top of it, you're recruiting future perverts. You're perverting the youth. You're corrupting them. And they were committing all kinds of pedophilia sins with them, and that kid grows up to be a pervert. So the devil, they're winning all over the place. So my point on John Gerson here is, and this is woefully insufficient, in the sense that I don't hear him condemning anything about the desecration of churches that has naked pictures in it. Now, we're going to read from on the pedophilia, which is explicitly mentioned in a bull of reform by the apostate Pope Alexander VI, the so-called Borgia Pope, who was absolutely immoral himself, we know that. But in this bull of reform, he makes mention and he implies that his cardinals, who are really apostate anti-cardinals, were molesting little boys. He refers to that in here, in his bull of reform. Here's what he says, and I'm going to read from the quote here. He basically says, I don't want the cardinals anymore to have boy body servants anymore. Because the cardinals had boy body servants and they were molesting the boys. And notorious heretic Ludwig Pasteur says it. He said by some of these things that he's reforming, you can imagine the sins that these so-called cardinals were committing. Now I'm going to read about this from the History of Popes. There is no doubt that in those sorrowful days in the summer of 1497, Alexander VI sincerely desired to and intended to institute certain reforms after his son Juan Borgia got killed. And then he really, that's the only thing that really got him to almost make a reform. The reform, a bull of reforms, very insufficient too, because he never hit the bullseye. The bullseye is scholasticism and the glorification of mythological gods and mythological religions, the things that he himself indulged in. He had it in the Borgia apartment. Talking about the scholasticism, he loved that, idolized the pagan philosophers. He never put that in the bull of reform. He always thought that was good, you see? And this is the thing all these guys are missing. So when they're trying to do reforms on the moral order, good reforms even, they never really succeeded because the sins against the faith, these guys never acknowledged, they even committed to themselves openly, obstinately. So that wasn't in his bull of reform, and it needed to be. Now, this bull of form, he never actually even promulgated this, because the cardinals, so-called cardinals, got so angry at him with all these reforms that they put a lot of pressure on him, and he never promulgated this bull of reform. And what happened after that, he got even worse than he was before. The Borgia, so-called pope, apostate anti-pope, got worse than even before. But the point I'm making in here is he's going to tell you what was in this bull of reform, one of the things that was in it. He says that, at last, the comprehensive bull of reform was drafted. The bull then proceeds to the reform of the College of Cardinals. The households of cardinals are not to employ boys and youths as body servants. Now, Pastor says, these regulations are in themselves enough to show what abuses have crept into the College of Cardinals. Why would you be doing that? They were molesting little boys. So pedophilia is nothing new. It started back then with the beginning of the great apostasy, even the 11th century, and it's running like full steam down to today. You know, and I, as a side note, even in the 1800s, when you had the Baltimore councils and these apostate cardinals in the United States, anti-cardinals, and in their their catechisms they put out, they don't condemn sodomy at all. You know, like the sins that cry out to God for vengeance, sodomy, they don't have it in there. They don't condemn sodomy at all in any one of their catechisms. It's not mentioned in the so-called Catholic Encyclopedia from the early 1900s. Sodomy's not even mentioned in there as a sin or anything. I mean, why are they leaving that out? Because they're committing sodomy. They don't even have it in there. You know, so anyway, I'm telling the people here, it's not just the Vatican II Church. This has been going on for 1,000 years. They've been molesting kids, homosexual sins, and all that. Now, we're going to go on a little bit. I think that's the gist of the reading I want to give you here. But here again, how art imitates the general condition of the people. You take a look at the Zeus raping Ganymede, which is prevalent throughout Rome and a lot of the churches. It's on the doors of St. Peter's. Zeus raping Ganymede. It's right there. And what that really is, Zeus abducts a young boy, and as you can see in these pictures right here by these perverted apostate artists, Zeus is abducting this young boy Ganymede, and then he goes on to rape him. In some pictures he's represented younger than other pictures, but he's a young man or a young boy, and then he rapes him. Now this is on the doors of St. Peter's Basilica. It's in the Borghese Palace. It's in several other places. So this, all the homosexuals love this, because this is homosexuality, and it's also pedophilia, because he's represented as a young boy. So you put that stuff on the doors, that means you're committing those sins. You've got the pedophilia demon, you got the homosexual demon in there. So now if you try to stop homosexuality and pedophilia, God will never allow. Look, you've got Zeus, the false god, up there on your doors abducting Ganymede, and then who goes on then to rape him. So here's how, or the art that they have imitates the way they're living. It's in their churches. It's still there down till today. We're now going to take a look at the crimes of fornication, adultery, concubinage, and bastard children. You know, homosexual sins aren't the only mortal sins, you know, of impurity or sexual perversion. Also, fornication, adultery. It's a mortal sin. You're going to hell for both things. So if you're fornicating, committing sins of impurity, if you're committing adultery, mortal sins, you're going to hell for them too. It's all related to sexual perversion. Well, these sins were rampant too, as you're going to read. And I'm reading first in the 11th century from testimony from Peter Damian in his letter 61 to Pope Nicholas II, and the letter's dated 1059. And I'm going to basically tell you what's in the letter, and I'm going to read it for you. He's writing to Pope Nicholas II, and he's telling him, concubinage is rampant among the bishops and priests. You got to do something to stop it. He says, what I really am angry about is that you're properly condemning and denouncing and punishing the priests, but the bishops weren't being condemned, denounced, or punished by the Pope or by any other people that had the power in synods or councils to do it. He was so angry at it, and he's yelling at the Pope, Conier, saying, if you don't punish the bishops, the sin's going to be on your own head. Like Eli said, the higher the rank the person is, the more he needs to be punished. Bishops need to be punished more than the lower clergy because they have a higher rank. It goes into the verse, I think, Wisdom 6:89, God will not accept any man's person, nor does he stand in awe of any man's greatness. For he made both a little and a great alike, and has equal care of both, and a greater punishment awaits the more mighty. And Jesus said in one of his verses, to whom much is given, much is expected. I think that's, if one of your brothers know the verse, it's in one of the Gospels.
Luke 12:48.
Too much is given, much is expected. It's a basic dogma of the church. The higher the person, the more he's punished, the more he should be denounced, and not the less. But as the great apostasy, this is part of non-punishmentalism, it's the opposite of the way around. The higher the prelate, not only is the less is he denounced, or the less is he punished, he's not denounced or punished at all. Peter Damian's talking about this. He said he went to a synod where these people are committing these crimes, these bishops, and nobody's condemning them. Nobody's denouncing them. Nobody's punishing them. He says, and you think the people don't know? He says, if it was secret, and they were doing these crimes in secret, I would say, fine, we can secretly, privately rebuke them. He says they're public. All the people know that they got bastard children walking all over the place and they're making jokes about it in the town. In the 11th century. And the popes weren't doing anything. So-called popes. This guy could even be suspect on this alone. I haven't time to study these individual popes. But now I told you sort of what the letter's about. Now I'm going to read it. It's a pretty long letter. But I'm just going to read parts of it. It's letter 61. Recently, as I conversed with several bishops by authority of your majesty, I sought to bar the door of their loins and tried, as it were, to apply safeguards of chastity to their priestly genitals. But this is a sect for which no one has a good thing to say. They had no fear of being punished by a synodal decree for practicing this vice of impurity. Indeed, in our day, the genuine custom of the Roman Church seems to be observed in this way, that regarding other practices of ecclesiastical discipline, a proper investigation is held, but a prudent silence is maintained concerning clerical sexuality for fear of insults from laymen. He's not even talking about just bishops. Even priests, evidently, they weren't condemning. Just maybe laymen that were committing impure sins. They weren't even condemning the priests, is what he's saying here. All right? So he says, when it comes to the bishops and priests, there's a prudent silence, he says. He calls it, for fear of insults from laymen. He goes, but this is something that badly needs correction, so that precisely what all the people are complaining about should not be hushed up in the councils by the leaders of the church. So, same thing we hear today when I heard those apostate bastards up in the St. Benedict's, that are like Brother Andre, the apostate bastard, freak pervert himself, who's yelling at me for exposing the crimes of apostate to Pope John Paul II as if they were secret crimes. I told him, how could it be secret if I know about it in North New Jersey? It's public. Everyone knows about it. And you keep your mouth shut about it? You share in his guilt. Equally in his guilt. Scandalize everybody else and give the air of people that it's okay what he's doing by keeping your mouth shut, by this type of silence that was going on in the 11th century. This thing that the St. Benedict Center's got, the SSP10, and all your so-called Catholics have out there, it's been going on for a long time. It's nothing new. It's part of non-judgmentalism and non-punishmentalism. And this is what he's complaining about right here. It's making him sick. I think he even left that synod and didn't stay at it because he couldn't even stay at it. It was so bad. Now, he goes on and says, but this is something that badly needs correction. So that precisely what all the people are complaining about should not be hushed up in council by the leaders of the church. For indeed, if this evil were secret, silence could perhaps somehow be condoned. A secret sin, you know. But you still have to condemn them secretly, but they weren't even doing that. But what a criminal situation. Shamelessly, this epidemic has been so audaciously revealed that everyone knows the houses of prostitution, the names of the mistresses, the fathers-in-laws, the mothers-in-laws, mothers-in-law, brothers, and other close relatives. And lest anything be lacking of these assertions, they give evidence of messengers running to and fro, of sending of presents, of the jokes they laughed at, and of their private conversations. And lastly, to remove all doubt, you have the obvious pregnancies and the babies. Therefore, because of the ignominy involved Everyone knew. He said everyone knew about it. They were joking about it in town, about the clerics having these mistresses and kids. I do not see how something that is everywhere publicly discussed can be suppressed by the synod. It was a Roman synod. So that not only the offenders be properly branded with infamy, but also that those whose duty is to punish them be found guilty. Because they didn't punish them. He's giving us an evidence of what's going on back then. The same thing is today. The Vatican II Church is not the only thing. We got a Renaissance Church who started this mess. Vatican II Church is just an extension of this. This kind of shame was not evident in the face of the priest Phineas, who in presence of all the people took up a spear against the Israelite and Midianite woman with whom he was having intercourse and transfixed them both through the genitals. Contrary to God's command, however, we are not impartial, for we indeed punish acts of impurity performed by priests in the lower ranks, but with bishops, we pay our reverence with silent toleration, which is totally absurd. Now he gets his part up to priests. Some of the priests they do punish, but the bishops, they don't say anything. And he goes, this is totally absurd. But notice that Phineas, roused by the zeal of the Holy Spirit, did not attack those who were unknown of a lower estate, but chose to kill outstanding and famous people to cause terror among the rest. And when you don't punish them because they're so prominent, everybody starts doing underneath that. And so while Phineas was quick to punish, especially those who were the leaders, to avenge the general acts of fornication of the whole people, as divine judgment in like manner, ordered the leaders of the people to be hanged on gallows. What are we to understand in all of this, if not the fact that the crime of adultery committed by eminent people must be harshly punished? And he who is aroused to punish such men doubtlessly wins peace from the heavenly judge and grace, not only for himself, but also for the people. Obviously, just as they who corrected sins were worthy of receiving a blessing, so too those who deal lightly with sinners were cursed. As the prophet said, a curse on him who withholds his sword from bloodshed. Jeremiah 48:10. One surely withholds his sword from bloodshed if he refrains from inflicting condign punishments on the wicked. He who fails to correct when it is possible for him to do so makes himself guilty of the other's sin. End quote of that. And it's a whole letter. You got to read this thing. What's going on back in his day? He's complaining to the Pope, and he needs to be investigated to allow this to go. I don't know how the Pope responded to this letter. That's what I need to study. But even the other bishops that were at this synod knew other bishops were committing these crimes, and he all kept mumbles McGee about the bishops. Oh, but you can get the priest or the lowly layman, maybe. It's what we see today. He's the Pope. No one can judge the Pope. No one can judge the priest. What a heresy that is. No one can judge the Pope. No one can judge a priest. You certainly can judge a Pope in his personal crimes and sins, and it's your duty to do so, even a priest or anyone, superiors, inferiors. There's no hold back when it comes to a Pope who commits sins and crimes or a bishop. So you see what's going on. This is the 1059 this letter was written. 1059. Already we got non-judgmentalism and non-punishmentalism running rampant. Now we read from the history of popes. Savonarola's attacks in the 15th century on the Italian, and especially the Roman clergy, this is the 15th century now, became more violent than ever. The scandals, he says, begin in Rome and run through the whole of the clergy. They are worse than Turks and Moors. When the evening comes, one goes to his concubine. Every priest has his concubine. All veils are cast aside. It has come to such a pass that all are warned against Rome. And the people say, if you want to ruin your son, make him a priest. Back then. Today, how much more so the same? I say, you want to make your kid a homosexual? You want to make him a pedophile? Definitely a heretic. Make him a priest. What do you see today? It's all over the place. And he says, but the point I'm impressing upon you people, this is nothing new. Watch out for these people we already know the Vatican II Church is a false church and all its crimes, and they keep harping only on the Vatican II Church, and they don't go back any further. That's a plot from the devil. They come up with 102 clown masses. Now I got 200 clown masses. They're still reading all the stuff of these bums out here, and they refuse to go back any further. So let this be an opening, awakening up for a lot of you people. So listen to what I'm saying and go back to where it began. And I'm saying, as you're reading here, the evidence on this. Now, as a result of all this too, I'd hate to tell you people, the apostate anti-pope Alexander VI, the so-called Borgia Pope, was not the only perverted pope. There were a lot of them. And a lot of them had concubines and bastard children. I'm only going to give you a list of some of them right here, right now. We're going to read from the Catholic Encyclopedia on Julius II, 1910. His, Julius II, apostate anti-pope Julius II, he does, early private life was far from stainless, as is sufficiently testified by the fact that before he became so-called pope, he was the father of three daughters, the best known of whom, Felice, he gave in marriage to Giovanni Giordano Orsini in 1506. So here we have Julius II. You know, he would have no right to be, his big pet thing that he liked, the good thing he was against was simony, but he had bastard children, concubines, he practiced astrology, and he financed and supported art that was against faith and art, which is against morals. So he did all these things. His pet thing that people say, oh, look, he was against simony. This is what they say today with the apostate anti-popes of Vatican II Church. Apostate anti-pope Francis I is against abortion. He's conservative. Are you kidding me? He supports the homos, pedophilia, and everything else. He's a heretic to the highest degree. He's a heresy with the Jews and all that. So I say, be careful. Just because even the most evil people in the world do some good things, don't be fooled by the good things, that the few good things that evil people do. You only have to do one mortally evil thing to be evil in the eyes of God. Now, we're going to read about more about this in here. Oh, that was the simony thing. What is this? Oh, no, I said that already about him already. Okay. We're going to read more about this again, from the history of popes. Undoubtedly, of all the evils which darkened Italian life in this period, the deadliest was the prevailing immorality. Contemporary writers are full of complaints on this subject, especially, of course, those of the preachers. Roberto de Lecce declares that the wickedness of his day exceeded that of the world before the flood. It cannot be denied that in smaller as well as the more important cities, immorality increased. And we're talking again about the 1400s and 15th century, to a terrible extent during the age of the Renaissance, and that especially amongst the cultivated and higher classes, revolting excesses were common. Illegitimate children were not accounted any disgrace, and hardly any difference was made between them and those born in wedlock. He's going to go on to say that's why they accepted the Borgia guy, because they didn't mind. They were all doing it. It was normal. They thought he's just like the rest of us. With a few honorable exceptions, almost all the Italian princes of the age of the Renaissance were steeped in vice. The crimes of the Borgia family were not without parallels in other princely houses. Aeneas Silvius Piccolomini, in the history of Frederick III, says, most of the rulers of Italy in the present day were born out of wedlock. When Pius II came to Ferrara in 1459, he was received by seven princes, not one of whom was a legitimate son. It is therefore not surprising that in an era of bastard dynasties, no one took umbrage at the origin of the Borgia family, or that little heed was paid to moral character in general. And that was in Volume 5, Introduction, Section 2, pages 113 to 114. And we're going to read also from Volume 5, Book 1, Chapter 6, page 388. In all these descriptions, nothing is said about Borgia's moral character, but it must not be inferred from this that it was unknown, but rather that public opinion in those days, not only in Italy, but also in France and Spain, was incredibly lenient on this point. Among the upper classes, a dissolute life was looked upon as a matter of course. In Italy especially, the prevailing state of things was deplorable. The profligacy of the rulers of Naples, Milan, and Florence at that time was something almost unheard of. The fact that the lives of many princes of the church were no better than those of temporal rulers gave little or no scandal to the Italians of the Renaissance. This was partly due to the general laxity of opinion in regard to morals. Nobody was condemning it. And if you don't condemn it, you're obviously not going to denounce the people that are doing it. And you're not going to punish them. Or some may have condemned it, but didn't denounce the people personally who were doing it. Or some condemned the sin, denounced the people, but didn't punish them. And they had the power to do so. You have all these things happening. How else could these things be so rampant, continue on, and progress? And don't be fooled. There's no time when these things ever ended. There's a period later on, maybe when they covered it up a little better, kept publicity out of Roman, made you not, these were going on from this day down till today. Now, we read about, a lot of it was going on in the back rooms too now. They were keeping it secret, you know. Now, we can also read from the history of popes in volume 5. Already in the 14th century in the towns of Italy, the number of unfortunate women leading a life of shame had been very great, prostitutes. The 15th century shows a notable increase in this class, even in small places like Orvieto and Perugia. In great international centers such as Venice, Rome, and Naples, as years went on, the state of things grew worse and worse. The chronicle Infessura estimates that the number of those unhappy creatures, prostitutes, in Rome in the year 1490 at 6,800. In Venice, in the beginning of the 16th century, their number was not less than 11,000 out of the population of 300,000. These are which we were talking about that before, your red light districts and all this, where they're gone down till today. Even the apostate Alphonse de Liguori, the notorious heretic and pig, taught that you're allowed to have like red light districts. It's better, and you can tell somebody instead of committing adultery, go to a prostitute instead. This stuff is all in the theology books too. So, and here it is that this time, this is the prostitution is actually out in the open here, like everything else. And even when they tried to stop something, they couldn't do it because they were sinning against the faith. Here they enjoyed considerable freedom in comparison with most other cities where various restrictions were imposed upon them. But in spite of such efforts, their numbers and their effrontery continued to increase. Again, they didn't hit the bullseye, which is the scholasticism, glorification of false gods and false religions. Those are the primary sins against the faith. So they couldn't even stop immorality when they wanted to, and even passed laws, good laws, to try to stop it. They couldn't do it, because God had them under the Romans' one curse. Another circumstance which requires to be noted is that towards the close of the 15th century, vice keeping pace with the diffusion of culture became itself more refined and consequently more dangerous. Now we're going to read about how the apostate anti-pope Innocent VIII had bastard children, and he was the apostate anti-pope right before the Borgia, so-called pope. We're going to read from the history of popes. The negotiations had lasted through the whole night. By the morning of the 29th, August 1484, Giuliano della Rovere had secured 18 votes for Cibo. Innocent VIII. The opposition party now gave up all resistance as useless. At 9 o'clock a.m., Cardinal Piccolomini was able to announce to the crowd assembled outside the Vatican that Cardinal Cibo had been elected and had assumed the name of Innocent VIII. Cardinal Battista Cibo, born in 1432, was the issue of this marriage. He studied at Padua and at Rome, and in his youth had no intention of taking orders. And his life at the licentious court of Aragon was no better than that of many others in his position. He had two illegitimate children, a daughter, Teodorina, and a son, Francescito. So, Lorenzo had considerable influence with the Pope at that time, for the marriage of Francesco Cibo was just about to take place. On November 13th, the bride entered Rome, accompanied by her mother. On the 18th, the Pope gave a banquet in honor of the bridal pair and made them a present of jewels worth 10,000 ducats. At the beginning of his pontificate, Innocent had refused to allow Francescito to reside in Rome. Now, with almost incredible weakness, he celebrated the nuptials in his own palace. This was the first time that the son of a pope, so-called pope, had been publicly recognized and, as it were, introduced into the political stage. This is the first time a so-called pope, we know he's an apostate anti-pope for other reasons, not for the bastard children, that alone would make him an anti-pope, but his glorification of mythology, images, desecration of churches, and so forth. But this is the first time that he actually brought his bastard kid out in public and had a public marriage with him. That's what he's saying here. Maybe there was one before that, but he's saying this is the first time they made him public in such a manner as that. And he goes, Aegidius of Viterbo justly passed this very severe judgment on Innocent VIII on account of this deplorable aberration. He's not even ashamed to bring his bastard kid out and let people know you're a pope and you got a concubine, you got a kid. Isn't this against clerical celibacy, which was, I think, 400 year, 500, when they're already instituted celibacy from that point forward. I mean, what a mockery of the laws of the church. What a mockery of disobedience. Why should these people expect to be obeyed when they're breaking every law of the church themselves, even natural law? Now, Of course, Alexander VI had bastards, and we'll just read about that briefly. Most everybody knows about him. And this is from the History of Pope. History of Popes, Volume 5. His Rodrigo Borgia's immoral course brought upon him a severe rebuke from Pius II. But nothing had any effect. Even after he had received priest orders, which took place in August 1468, and when he was given the bishopric of Albano, which he afterwards exchanged in 1476 for that of Porto, he still would not give up his dissolute life to the end of his days. He remained a slave of the demon of sensuality. From the year 1460, Venosa de Catinis, born of Roman parents in 1442, was his acknowledged mistress. She was married three times, and her husbands were still living on top of it, so he's not just having a concubine, he's committing adultery. In 1474, to Domenico of Arrigano, in 1480, to the Milanese Gregorio de Croci, and in 1486, to a Mantuan Carlo Canali, and died in Rome on the 26th of November, 1518, age 76. The names of the four children whom she bore to the cardinal are inscribed on her tomb in the following order. Caesar, he has here, or Cesare, Juan, Joffrey, and Lucrezia. Besides these, Cardinal Rodrigo had other children, a son Pedro Louis, certainly born before 1460, and a daughter, Gerolama, but apparently by a different mother. Rodrigo turned to his Spanish home for his careers of these children who were legitimized one after another. So he wrote up letters legitimizing it, and everything's fine, and kept him at the papal court, gave him high positions and all that. It's horrible. I'm now going to talk about the crimes of immoral and heathen plays, dances, and gluttonous banquets, which were taking place at this time. I'm going to read from the History of Popes, Volume 5, Introduction, Section 2, pages 123 to 126. In Rome, classical plays probably first began to be acted in the reign of Innocent VIII and were not long restricted to small circles of humanists. Very soon, the worldly-minded cardinals and other church dignitaries opened the doors of their places to Pomponius Laetus and his dramas. Cardinal Raphael Riario especially patronized the stage with princely magnificence. Under Alexander VI, the taste for theatrical representations made great progress. Plays, for the most part, of an extremely objectionable character, were a prominent feature in all court festivities and also in the carnival amusements, in which Alexander took a great interest. In 1502, the Pope had the Menechmi performed in his own apartments, and under Leo X, it flowed freely. He was not ashamed to be present at a sumptuous representation of Cardinal Bibbiani's immoral play. He's the one that has, here's a picture of Cardinal Bibbiani's pornographic bathroom in the Apostolic Palace you're looking at right now. He was not ashamed to be present at a sumptuous representation of Cardinal Bibbiani's immoral play, Calandria, which was put on the stage for the first time at Urbino during the carnival in 1513. Machiavelli's plays surpassed even those of Ariosto and Bibbiana in absence of decorum. His Mandragola, the magic drink, is the worst. Nothing more detestable could be invented than the incident which he describes in his masterly prose. Unbridled passion and the lowest desires are the main theme of the play. In its clever and sparkling dialogue, adultery is held up to admiration. Even the humanist Giglio Gregorio Giraldi exclaims, "What times, what morals, all the vileness of the heathen drama, which had been driven out by Christianity, has returned again." The repaganization of the world. He's saying this was driven out in the early days of Christianity, and now it's revived again. In regard to the drama, there were two distinct worlds: the court circle, in which plays of this kind were admired and enjoyed, and the educated middle class, which continued to relish and cultivate the sacred drama, the influence of which was invaluable as a countercheck to the sensuous tendencies of the Renaissance. This, however, would not last. The movement towards the revival of The classical stage, inaugurated by the humanists, swept steadily onwards, and in the course of time, the religious drama became extinct. Now we also read from the History of Popes, Volume 4. The popes, Sixtus IV's two famous nephews, Pietro Riario and Giuliano della Rovere. Pietro Riario was a very different character. He was intelligent and cultivated, courteous, witty, cheerful, and generous. But his good qualities were counterbalanced by a lust of power, a boundless ambition and pride, and a love of luxury, which rendered him utterly unworthy of the purple. Unfortunately, Sixtus IV fostered these faults by lavishing rich benefices on him, even more abundantly than on the Cardinal of St. Pietro in Vincoli. Before the year 1473 was over, Riario again gave an entertainment on yet a larger scale, surpassing in mad extravagance anything that the sumptuous age of the Renaissance had yet produced. The occasion for this further display was the passage through Rome of Leonora, the daughter of the King of Naples, on her way to her husband, Ericola of Ferrara. On Whit Monday, Riario gave a banquet in her honor, which in its sumptuous and unreasonable luxury recalled the heathen days of imperial Rome. If the silk-clad servants and the splendid decoration of the hall, the great sideboard with its 12 epergnes and masses of silver plate was enough to astonish the guests, the feast itself was even more marvelous. Before its commencement, sweetmeats, oranges encrusted with sugar, and malvoisie were offered to the company, and then rose water for the hands. The guests took their places at the table to the sound of trumpets and fifes. Only 10 persons sat at the principal table with Leonora, 8 belonging to her suite, her host and Girolamo Riario. The banquet lasted 6 whole hours. There were 3 courses, during which 44 dishes were served. Amongst them were stags roasted whole in their skins, goats, hares, calves, herons, peacocks with their feathers, and finally a bear with his staff in his jaws. Most of the dishes were for show. The bread was gilt, the fish and other viands were brought to the table overlaid with silver. The sweets and confectionaries were countless and of all sorts of artistic shapes. Amongst other devices, the labors of Hercules were represented the size of life. Now we get into mythology, entering into the banquets. And a mountain with a gigantic and apparently living serpent, sugar fortresses with towers and citadels from which banners waved, were borne in and thrown among the people from the balcony. 10 great ships sailed and made a confectionery and laden with sugar and almonds, which in allusion to the arms of the Rovere were shaped like acorns. Next came the triumph of Venus. Venus, drawn in a chariot by swans. Then a mountain from which a man also appeared during the feast, amongst others, a youth who sang verses in Latin and announced, "At the command of the Father of the gods, I am come and bring you joyful news. Envy us no longer the festivals of our heaven, for Jupiter himself is a guest at your board." And this is the so-called Pope's, what was it they said, his, as I read in the beginning, this is Sixtus IV. Who's allowing this happening with him, under him. This was his nephews, one of his nephews, doing this. No doubt, maybe he was even there, I don't know, but that's his nephew, knows about it, right? This is, all the stuff was up in the churches anyway, but you see how they're imitating, the art is imitating the way they're behaving here? It says, towards the end of the entertainment, a ballet was danced on the stage by ancient heroes with their mistresses. While it was going on, 10 centaurs suddenly burst in upon the scene with little wooden shields and clubs and were driven away by Hercules, Bacchus, and also Andromeda were represented, and other things, says a writer, belonging to the prince's suite, which I do not remember or do not understand, as I am not a proficient in humanistic studies. There's that heathen banquet you're talking about by this so-called, this apostate anti-pope Sixtus IV's nephew. We read also again in the History of Popes, Volume 5, the evil increased rapidly in the time of Lorenzo de' Medici, and some families were brought to utter ruin by sheer prodigality and luxury. The banquet given by Bernardetto Salutati and his fellow craftsmen in 1476 to the sons of King Ferrante is an instance of the extremes to which this was sometimes carried. It resembled the notorious orgy of Cardinal Pietro Riario. There is no denying the downward tendency which characterized the 15th century. Now we're going to read about what was going on under Apostate Antipope Innocent VIII from History of Popes, Volume 5. In the year 1484, Angelo Polizano came to Rome with the Florentine Embassy of Obedience. On that occasion, the Pope, Innocent VIII, in presence of an illustrious company, ordered him to make a Latin translation of the historical works of the Greeks, referring to the exploits of the Romans so that they might be more accessible to the majority of readers. In obedience to this flattering command, Poliziano selected Herodian for his translation and endeavored to make it read as it would have done had the author written it in Latin. Innocent VIII rewarded the dedication of this work with a special brief and a gift of 200 ducats in order to set the translator free to devote himself more completely to the work of this kind. Poliziano thanked the Pope in a beautiful sapphic ode in which both thought and language reflect the spirit of classical poetry. And Poliziano was one of the humanists that was immoral and also idolatrous. Innocent VIII accepted dedications also from Tito Vespasiano Strozzi, Peter Marsus, and the celebrated physician Gabriele Zerbi. He bestowed marks of distinction also on foreign humanists such as Johann Fussmagen. Now we're going to read one of the many heathen banquets under the apostate antipope Alexander VI, and this one took place during the wedding of his daughter Lucrezia Borgia to Giovanni Sforza. And it's from the History of Popes, Volume 6. On the 12th of June, 1493, the marriage of Lucrezia Borgia and Giovanni Sforza of Pesaro was celebrated at the Vatican with great pomp in the presence of Alexander VI. At the wedding feast, the Pope and 12 cardinals sat down at the table with the ladies who were present, among whom was the notorious Giuliana Farnese. That was his whore that he was fooling around with. You sit right next to him. When the banquet was over, says the Farnese envoy, the ladies danced as an interlude. We had an excellent play with much singing and music. The Pope and all others were there. And it was a lewd dance. It wasn't a good dance. They did immoral things too. I don't know if he says that here, but we'll see. What more can I say? My letter would never end were I to describe it all. Thus we spent the whole night, whether well or ill, will leave to your highness to determine. Now we go on to read about the same event here. On the 30th of December, Lucrezia's marriage. This is Alfonso's marriage now. On the 30th December, Lucrezia's marriage with Alfonso by procuration was celebrated with great splendor in the Vatican. The bride's dress was of gold brocade and crimson velvet trimmed with ermine. The hanging sleeves touched the ground, and her long train was borne by maids of honor. A black band confined her golden hair, and she wore on her head a light coif of gold and silk. Her necklace was a string of pearls with a lock consisting of an emerald, a ruby, and one large pearl. From thence until the day of her departure, 6 January 1502, one entertainment succeeded another in perpetual round of gaiety. Plays among others, Plautus, here's an immoral guy, Plautus Menachemini, balls and allegorical representations alternated with racist tournaments and bullfights. These are immoral plays that we're talking about here. And even heretical and idolatrous plays. The Pope permitted himself to be present at scandalous dances, immoral, of similar character to those which had drawn on him the rebuke of Pius II in former days. Society at that time was so corrupt that even this gave but little offense. Everything bad was believed, but no one thought much of anything. So they didn't care, all sinners. They all thought, hey, a bunch of sinners just enjoying themselves, you know, and having a great time, according to them. So he was, you know, this is like leader, like, you know, our Lord says that people get the rulers they deserve. Okay, that's the end of that section. This recording was produced by Mary's Little Remnant, 302 East Joffrey Street, Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, 87901-2878, and can be accessed on my website at www.johnthebaptist.us.